Sun and sunshine. My wife hates it, but I love it. Let's get.
Understand your word. I pray that you'll be with us.
Okay.
Important.
Okay, great. So we're moving on to a new letter today. The letter to the church in Philippi. So, the first, thanks, Dorian, it was just you or whoever helped to organize this quarter for teaching. I like what you've done here. There's only four chapters, but chapters aren't organized very well in Philippians. So I like that we're going to spend 6 or 7 weeks on this letter. And so I have the privilege of orienting us and getting us started with context of the letter and what's going on. We do have 2 pages to get through, so we'll see if we can do it. A little bit about the history to begin with of the city Philippi. In 356 BC, Philip II of Macedon came through and conquered this town. It was called Crinides at the time, which is Greek for fountains. The city overwhelmingly covered with springs, there was a lot of water, and that really leads to it being kind of a wealthy town as we move on to look at it. Philip II, of course, was the father of Alexander the Great, so that gives you some context. He renamed this city Philippi after himself, and it remained so until it ceased to be a city more than a millennium later. Philippi was a wealthy place. There were gold mines there, and it contributed a lot to the overall wealth of the Macedonian Empire there for 2 centuries leading up to the Roman rule. So it was a major city far north of northern Greece, what's Greece now, but Macedonia, very far up north there. A notable event that happened there, to give you some context, in 42 BC, the Battle of Philippi. This was the end to the major squabble that transformed the Roman Republic into an empire. So the final vengeance was delivered for Julius Caesar in Philippi. Both Cassius and Brutus killed themselves there because they could see the inevitable victory that Mark Antony and Octavius were bringing with their armies. And so they chose to end their lives there. Interesting note that I read recently, Plutarch records that Antony covered Brutus's body with a purple garment as a sign of respect. So interesting as we get into the story of Philippi and Lydia and the businesses that are there. So by the time the New Testament and where we'll be reading, Philippi has now been made into a Roman colony. So that has special status above other cities or conquered places in the Roman Empire. It's really an extension of Rome itself. So landowners there are exempt from land taxes, poll taxes. There's all kinds of benefits to living there. And these colonies were set up as retirement cities for Roman soldiers who happened to live out the full 25 years of service. They'd be given a land grant when they formed the colony. So, yes. Thanks, Jim. So that's kind of the what we see with Philippi. There's going to be a lot of Roman soldiers retired. There's a lot of wealth. There's gold. There's tons of water. It's a good thoroughfare for travel. A high profile city. So that I help everybody get oriented with the city. Okay. Now the church in Philippi. When did it get started? Well, Paul, Silas, and Timothy responded to what we all call the Macedonian call, right? I think that's the first blank on the sheet. And that was, from as good as we can tell, around 50 AD. So that's where we're going to start in the Word. So if you want to turn to Acts 16. And we'll read verses 6 through 15. Let's see, Acts 16:6. So they, Paul, Silas, Timothy, and their companions passed through the Phrygian and Galatian region, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. And when they had come to Mysia, they were trying to go into Bithynia, and the Spirit of Jesus did not permit them. And passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas. And a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A certain man of Macedonia was standing and appealing to him and saying, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." And when he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. Let's stop this right there for a minute. I think Tad brought up this example last week or whenever he was preaching, a week or two ago, talking about God's providential work in evangelism. And I think this is a great example of that. God knows where the fruit is going to be brought next. And God knows that there are hearts ready to hear the word in this wealthy city of Philippi. And that maybe there aren't any hearts ready yet in some of these other cities that Paul is near. And God's choosing to use Paul's talents more efficiently and effectively right now and take him where there's going to be fruit. That's a hopeful thing for me when I think of the lost and the hearts out there that are lost and who are looking and ready to hear the truth. God's going to make a way for them to hear the truth.
I always wonder now, God's still leading us, don't you think? But it's in a little different way. It's not in the miraculous way of God speaking to them and telling them. So how does God direct us today?
I think there's providential care that puts opportunities in our path. And it's hard to understand.
It may be something we don't already really realize, but maybe we'll have a thought come in our mind. You know, I've prayed about a certain situation and wake up the next morning and think, oh, well, That might be it. Yeah. And, you know, not the same as what they had back then. But
well, sometimes we can see the fruit after that, and in hindsight, we can see God's hand in putting the right opportunities and situations together for the good of his people. Any other comments on this? Okay, moving on to verse 11. Therefore, putting out to sea from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace, and on the day following to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city in the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony, and we were staying in the city for some days. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside, where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. What do we notice here?
It's women.
Yes, women.
And no place to, no church.
And no place to go find them. No synagogue in the city.
No synagogue.
No synagogue in the city. It's kind of evident from this chapter, but if you look at the next chapter, 17:1, when he has left Philippi and continues through Macedonia, he arrives in Thessalonica, and the first thing he says is, where there was a synagogue of the Jews, and so as was my custom, I went there. Nothing. So it just further emphasizes the point. There's no synagogue in Philippi. So where were they going to go? They thought, go down the roof. They've got to be here somewhere. God sent us here. Right? There was someone calling for us. So they went down to the river on the Sabbath and found these women. Verse 14, let's see. A certain woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening, and the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. So, a little bit about Lydia. Where is she from?
Thyatira.
Why is she in Philippi?
She is a merchant.
She's a merchant. What's she selling?
Purple cloth.
Purple cloth. what happens to be the main export from Thyatira at this time? Dyed clothing, dyed textiles. Yeah, it's a major dyeing, lots of dyeing facilities there, and purple cloth is their major export. She's chosen to go to a wealthy city, and it appears that she's taking her home dyeing product and exporting it from there, importing it into Philippi. This wealthy,
purple goods were expensive, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Were they more expensive dye than most other colors?
Yeah, they're rare. There's a few plants, right, indigo and others. I was actually reading this, the Roman, the Caesars and the royal family and everything had a special purple that they got from Lebanon, from some sea snail creature, really rare. But all the purple is rare. That's the exceptional one. So I kind of did a little research on that, history buff, but that really rare one, about 150 years later, by Roman law, no one else could wear Lebanese sea snail purple except the royal family, which is interesting. But yes, all purple is, you know, a sign of respect and high class. You had one?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Purple was for the royalty.
Yeah. Okay. So the church is established here with Lydia as the first convert in her household. Paul stays in her home, so the church there in her home is where the church in Philippi started and grew from there. Continuing on in Acts 16, the rest of the chapter there, we probably won't read that, but let's kind of talk through it and summarize. I think we all know the story. I'll start and someone else can jump in. Paul winds up getting flustered by a girl following him around who keeps yelling at them. These are, you know, what does she say? You're working for the, you're bondservants of the Most High God. And this girl was making money for her masters. She's not free. By fortune-telling, divination, and she's consumed by some kind of spirit that's giving her that ability. So she knows who Paul and Silas are, and she's running around causing a ruckus. And what does Paul do?
He cast out the spirit.
Yeah. Both answers are correct. Yes, I would say, right? Cast that spirit out of her. To what end? What happens?
Makes her masters mad.
Right.
Because they cost them income.
Okay. Now they don't have anyone to do the fortune telling in town. They don't have an income. So they go right to the magistrates. Who do what?
Put Paul and Silas in jail.
Not before doing what?
Beating
them. Right? They strip them, beat them, and throw them in jail. Which is apparently the common practice for non-citizens. Who that citizens are angry with. Turns out, Paul and Silas are what? Roman citizens. And should not have been beaten and thrown in jail. But they endured it. They sing through the night. What does God do in the middle of the night?
Opens the cell.
Yeah, opens the cell doors. There's an earthquake, opens the cell doors. The chains are released. Everyone could go free if they want, but no one does. But what does this show?
Well, it shows several things. One, of course, is the power of God. It shows the faith of Paul and Silas. You know, it shows you've got prisoners that did not run away, apparently, when they could have. You've got the jailer believed and was converted.
Yep.
A lot of things happened.
A lot of things happened. I think you actually just mentioned a lot of the themes that I think we'll cover in the book of Philippians that Paul and Silas endured: humility, hardship, hope beyond that suffering, having joy even in circumstances, right? All of these come out in the book, in the letter to the Philippians as well.
Michael, I got a question about verse 17. This girl that was doing this divination stuff, she really was not saying anything untruthful, was she? And she said, she cried out saying, these men are the servants of the Most High God who proclaim us the way of salvation. That's exactly truthful. But Paul stops her from doing that. So what's our lesson here? Well, I suppose there's a lot of people that try to tell other people about Christ, but they do it for reasons like for making money, I guess you might say.
Maybe.
I mean, we have big time preachers that have these mega churches that, you know, are probably telling lots of things that are probably truthful. Maybe not everything, but Paul takes that away from her.
But Paul was greatly annoyed. So she's doing it in an annoying way.
And what's divination? What does that mean? Wasn't she speaking
demons?
Well, I looked up the Greek word there. It's actually a spirit of Python, and it has to do with the Oracle of Delphi and Apollos. And so it really is about fortune telling and telling the future.
I think it shows that the Lord doesn't have any partnership with that.
Sure.
I think that's
a good point, Theta. I think that what she said, Paul really was just, Theta said that it also shows that even if someone's speaking truth from the wrong, you know,
from the demon side,
God doesn't want any part of that. Right? So that's probably a good point as well. I kind of think she was really just being chaotic and getting in the way of Paul and Silas being able to go about and talk to people. She's just constantly there.
This is over many days.
Yeah. Yeah, Jason?
Well, we know that it wasn't her that was saying these things.
Right.
It was this thing that was imbuing her with power inside of her. And, you know, I just got done on Wednesday talking about some stories very similar to this. And this, to me, sounds very, very similar to the story of Jesus, where, you know, the demons were calling out to him, saying, oh, we know who you are. We know who you are. And he casted out those demons from those people. He rebuked them. He silenced them. Mm-hmm. And to me, this sounds very similar in that, you know, maybe she was revealing them and she was bringing out, you know, who they were before maybe it was time. You know, they probably had their own, you know, timing that they wanted to reveal things.
Some kind of agenda there and, mm-hmm. and more than likely impeding the work that Paul and Silas are trying to do. Mm-hmm. Is the feeling that I get there. Yeah, what comes of this? Paul and Silas are in jail because they cast out the spirit of divination. They're beaten unlawfully. At night, they sing praises, earthquake, and a conversion of the jailer is brought about because of that. And so now we have two full households who have been converted. And you can see the beginning of the church there. So from its beginnings. From there, Paul, Silas, and Timothy continue to preach down through Macedonia. They stay at Berea, Acts 17:14. Silas and Timothy stay in Berea, Acts 17:14, and Paul goes on to Athens and Corinth, and then Silas and Timothy catch up with him in Corinth in Acts 18:15. And then several years later, if you turn over to Acts 20, verses 1 through 6, you see another mention of Philippi as Paul and Timothy and others, including Tychicus, travel through Philippi. Acts 20, verse 1, after the uproar had ceased in Ephesus, Paul sent for the disciples, and when he had exhorted them and taken his leave of them, he departed to go to Macedonia. And when he had gone through those districts and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. And there he spent 3 months, and when a plot was formed against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria, he determined to return through Macedonia. And he was accompanied by Sopater of Berea, the son of Pyrrhus, and by Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy, and Tychicus, and Trophimus of Asia. But these had gone ahead and were waiting for us at Troas. And we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread and came to them at Troas within 5 days. So several more times that Paul had opportunity to travel through Philippi and know those people there and monitor the growth of the church and help them and encourage them. So he's built quite the relationship with the Christians in Philippi. Any other comments here? We'll move on to number three.
I just have one question. Lydia, is she a Gentile?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't think we know for sure. She's worshiping in the Jewish way.
Right.
But that could be like Cornelius believed in Yahweh God, but don't think he was really a proselyte. He hadn't converted to Judaism, but he was worshiping God. Maybe she had converted. I think we have enough information. Anyone else read any background in other accounts for more information? Did you know she worshipped Yahweh God? And her heart was ready to hear the new message. All right, author and audience. So Paul writes several letters all around the same time. The one that we're getting ready to study to the Christians in Philippi, as well as to Ephesus, Colossae, and his personal letter to Philemon, all during this time. It's about 10 years after the initial meeting with Lydia and the Philippian jailer. So it's somewhere between 60 and 64. Where is Paul? Well, let's take a look at that. We turn over to the book of Philippians. All of these letters are called the prison epistles for good reason. It's fairly evident that Paul is in prison in Rome. We can start in chapter 1, verses 12 through 14. Somebody read that.
But I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel, so that it has become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear.
Okay, so where is, what is nearby him?
The
palace guard, the Praetorian Guard. Paul's in prison near the Praetorian Guard. In verses 21 through 26 of chapter 1. Someone read those verses.
For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But I live in the flesh. This will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I cannot tell. For I'm hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again.
All right, so Paul's expressing his hope that he's going to be soon released from his imprisonment and see the brethren in Philippi again. In chapter 2, 24, he says, I myself also shall be coming shortly. He's hoping that he's going to be able to be released from this. And then lastly, in chapter 4, 22, as he's giving his final greetings, all the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. Pretty evident. He's in prison and he's in Rome.
It also shows that he converted some of Caesar's household.
Absolutely.
They call them saints.
Yeah, that's right. How did this letter get to Philippi?
Used to have been delivered by a man named Epaphroditus.
There you go. In chapter 2, verse 25. I thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger and minister to my need. So Epaphroditus came from Philippi as a messenger from them, brought financial resources. We'll see more about that in a minute. And it appears that he's going to be the one to deliver this letter back to Philippi on his return. And these other letters that he's writing to Ephesus and Colossae and Philemon are likely going to be carried by Tychicus and Onesimus as they go back to Asia and deliver those letters. And we can find those references in Ephesians 6 and Colossians 4. So the Christians in Philippi, as we get into this letter, it's important to know what kind of people are living in Philippi. What kind of people are the saints now who have been converted there? So 3 points here. First one, the Christians in Philippi were very generous. This is overwhelmingly a characteristic that's talked about. So let's just quickly look at these. Philippians 4, 14 through 18. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction, and you yourselves also know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. So, not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek for the profit which it increases to your account. But I have received everything in full and have an abundance. I am amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent, the fragrant aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. So they sent, while Paul's in prison, they sent financial resources to Paul via Epaphroditus. 10 years earlier, he mentions here, the Philippians were the sole funding church to make sure that Paul's evangelism down into through Macedonia and down into Greece is accomplished. And that's really significant. That's not just giving to an evangelist. That's giving to an evangelist for people you don't care much about down in southern Greece. They're up in northern Macedonia. The history between these two places is not good. Each one wants to lord themselves over the other. This is the Greek version of the Good Samaritan story. We talk about Jews and Samaritans all the time. This is Macedonians and Greeks. They're the sole financier to make sure Paul can get down there to Corinth and Athens and do his work and teach people. That is really significant about their generosity and their character.
Now, that's pretty great that they're, like you say, those are mainly Greeks, you know, but yet they're thinking about the Jews from back in Jerusalem. So there's a connection now that you're getting that East and West now coming together. And from there on, it keeps going.
Yeah, and that's the next one on the list. We can see that in 2 Corinthians 8, 1 through 4, that the churches in Macedonia, including Philippi, give liberally to the support of the saints in Jerusalem. Yeah. And Paul calls it out as an example for others to follow when he gets to Corinth, if you remember. He says, boy, I told those folks up in Macedonia that you guys were going to give liberally too. So yeah. Don't make me a liar. Right? Secondly, so the Philippians are very generous people. They live in a wealthy city, they've been blessed by God, and they are not afraid to share that. I think that's a great message for us as well. Secondly, they share in a spirit of unity and joy. I just plucked out a few. If you just, you know, kind of hop from chapter to chapter, and we'll see the details of this over the next few weeks as we go through it. But look at some of those. Philippians 1:27. He wishes to hear that they stand firm in one spirit, one mind, together for the faith. Philippians 2:2. Make my joy complete by maintaining the same love, spirit, and purpose which you have. Notice he says maintain. They already have this unified spirit. They're of one mind, one spirit, one love, one purpose. In Philippians 2:4, they look out for the interests of others. In 3:1, they rejoice in the Lord. In 4:1, Paul calls them his beloved brethren twice. He says they're my joy and crown, and that they stand firm in the Lord, and he hopes they continue to do so. In 4 and 5, he says, let your gentleness be known to all men. And that word gentleness is so much more than gentleness. This is not rolling over gentleness. This is the Greek word is gentle, forbearing, fair, moderate, reasonable. It's having a sober, moderate mind and handling things in that kind of godly spirit. And he says, you all have it. You all have that godly spirit of gentleness and fairness and forbearing with one another. He does mention in all of these four chapters, there's one mention of one correction that needs to be done in Philippi, and that's in chapter 4 and verse 2. And it's just a brief little statement. Hey, by the way, in all of your unity and love and reasonableness and gentleness and fairness and godly spirits and ways, can you help these two women, Euodia and Syntyche, to get along with each other? They're apparently having some sort of little squabble, not getting along. And what's different about this than other letters that we've seen?
A lot of the other letters is the Paul sandwich, encouragement, the correction, and like Corinthians, there's a lot of correction, and then encouragement again at the end. But this is almost completely encouragement.
Yeah, this is 180 degrees from the letter to Corinth, right? This church gets it. These folks are mature. A little bit of correction needs to go on. Hey, we're all human. There's going to be things that can happen, and we should sweep them under the rug, and he doesn't. But this is overwhelmingly an encouraging letter, and a group of Christians who are doing the right thing are great examples for us.
Another thing I thought about, too, that's unusual, you know, you mentioned Corinth. Corinth was rich also, okay? But Philippi is the one that gave. And, you know, the rule, pretty much the rule is the more you have money or possessions, the more you want to keep it, and the less generous you are with it. And that seemed to be Corinth. But on the other hand, here's Philippi that had a lot, and they were actually doing what they should be.
Yeah, great point, Mike. Overcoming that the human fleshly side of our nature to hold on to what we have is an overwhelming expression of how mature they are getting in godly spirit.
Yeah, in 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, he talks about that.
Right.
Yeah. And he uses one to try to encourage the other one. So.
Mm-hmm. That plays off the competitive
nature. He said Corinth, but like Mike said, they had a year to put theirs together, and it sounded like they didn't have it together yet.
Right, right. Okay, moving into the letter itself, themes and structure. So what are the themes, what are some of the themes that we're going to see throughout the letter in Philippians? I'm sure you've all just read it this week, right?
We only got about 3 minutes.
So, joy, right? Joy, humility, hardship, God's glory. We'll see some of those themes in every chapter come out. The structure, again, this goes to the great organization. Thank you, Blaine. Actually, dividing it by topic matter so that we can get to it. Today, the greeting, the opening prayer, and next week, we'll have the update on Paul's situation. Then Paul wants to lay out Jesus as an example to be followed. Then he lays out Timothy, Epaphroditus, and himself as examples to follow. And then he gives a challenge to follow all these examples, keep doing it, and then his closing remarks. It's an overwhelmingly encouraging letter. First 11 verses here, real quick. What is Paul's attitude toward the brethren in Philippi? Let me read verses 1 through 4 and answer that question.
Paul and Timothy, servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus who are at Philippi with the overseers and the deacons, grace to you and peace from God our Father and Lord Jesus Christ. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always in prayer of mine for you all making my prayer with joy. He's extremely thankful.
He's thankful, joyful for them, yes. Question 2 in verses 5 and 6. Why is Paul joyful when his thoughts turn to the Christians in Philippi? In view of your participation in the gospel from the first day until now, for I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Christ Jesus. Why is Paul thankful and joyful?
How many are faithful?
Yeah. And they gave. If you so the word in my translation is partnership there. You have other words there. That's the Greek word koinonia. It's used other places to talk about partnership, fellowship, right? We have koinonia with one another. We have koinonia with Christ. He's talking about their participation, their sharing in the evangelism of the gospel. How did they do that? With the money they had. That was their gift. Was they were wealthy and could do that, and they did it, and they supported the preaching of the gospel over and over, participated in that. And he's confident that they're going to keep on doing it until Christ comes back. That's why he's thankful. And then what does Paul pray for the Philippian Christians in verses 9 through 11? Somebody read those verses.
And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God.
So what's his prayer?
Growth.
Growth in?
Knowledge.
Knowledge, sincerity, righteousness, all supporting the growth and love that they have for one another. And he calls these the excellent things. So my last comment for this morning is, notice the linkage from this passage right here to the very end. It comes back to Philippians 4:8.
Seems to be one of his favorite churches.
It is. He comes back to
you. He really likes it.
Yeah. Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, pure, lovely, good repute, these are the excellent things. Dwell on those. So he starts the letter with those excellent things, that they grow in those, just wish that they grow in those, and ends in those. Any other comments as we close out?
Keep thinking as we're reading through this, to whom much is good and much is required. And they were given a lot, they were blessed in a lot of ways, and they gave a lot.
Great point, Clayton. Yeah. And Travis will pick us up next week with the next section. And everyone, these are our friends from Georgia, Destiny Choate, Samantha Plumack, Jaden and Brandon Wilson, and their two kids.